All right, welcome everybody to our breakout session, Communicating with Conservatives, What is Working? For those of you that don't know me, I am Drew Eyerly, the Conservative Outreach Director for Citizens Climate Lobby. Helping me host this breakout session is Nate Abercrombie, our Conservative Outreach Coordinator. It has definitely been a challenge the last few months around reconciliation. And a lot of our focus has really turned to outreach at the grassroots level, helping all of your local chapters and everything really kind of develop their talking points. And what we've learned through this process is that there's not a one size shoe fits all for conservatives. For me, myself, I'm down here in Georgia. The type of conservative up in New York, DC, over in Oregon, they care about different things. So we really wanted to bring somebody to the table that is well-versed, well-spoken, and has been at this game for a long time. So I'd like to introduce Ian Harrison. For those of you that don't know him, he is our Conservative Caucus Chair. He's become somebody that I have learned to lean on, bounce opinions off of, and really gives me straightforward, honest answers. And couldn't be more happy to know him and have him here to talk with us today. Ian?
Okay, so as I said, my name's Ian Harrison. I'm the latest, if you like, in a long line of people that have taken the Conservative Caucus Chair position. I've been in CCL now since around 2017. And I've probably been to about 40 lobby meetings, I guess. So I've had some experience on the lobby front. I'm a Republican. I'm a conservative. You can tell also that I wasn't born here. I guess I'm conservative, and I understand what that means in the American sense of the word. So I will talk to you, I guess, about being a conservative rather than how to talk to conservatives. And I think this is the real difference, frankly. There is no process by which you talk to a conservative if you are not a conservative, in some special code or language, because no such language exists. Fundamentally, conservatives have, of course, I have a worldview which has been formed in the same way that it is for most of us. I have education, our parents, our given experience. When we think about climate change, we think about climate change as we do with all other issues in that way through the conservative lens, which tends to be things like doing things incrementally, mitigating risk, if you like, dealing with your local issues first, being less worried, for instance, about global issues than you are about national issues or local issues, and relying a great deal on the market mechanisms that we have trusted in this country for the last couple of hundred years to build the wealth and prosperity that we have, along with our security. The challenge with climate change is that it is global, for one thing. It is an enormous, multifaceted problem. It transcends national borders, and it would appear at the moment that urgent global action is required by essentially unelected leaders, if you like, intrastate, national, beyond state borders. And that is difficult for conservatives to work with and address with. So what we need to do if we're going to think about climate change is remind ourselves of some conservative principles. I am at CCL because carbon fee and dividend was the most sensible solution that I had ever encountered to climate change as a conservative. And I spent some time trying to work out how we were actually going to address this. And so one of the things to bear in mind is that the very thing that we propose, if you like, what CCL and other organizations are actually interested in, fits very neatly in this particular conservative's toolkit. And I think it fits in other people's toolkits in the conservative space as well. The reason that CF&D fits so well in that space is largely because it relies, it is a market mechanism. It relies on and expects the power of the market to solve the problem. And when a properly regulated market is in that space, that's exactly what's going to happen. So this particular conservative, as I said, believes very strongly in that process. So what are we actually going to talk about in terms of how you learn to talk to conservatives? Well, we've said stay on market mechanism. Second thing is keep it local. One of the things that has to be recognized is that there's going to be impacts in any specific given district or environment. And as Drew just pointed out, this is something which is taken much more seriously from the conservative perspective, I believe, than it is necessarily taken from the Democratic or the left political perspective. There does not need to be, in the mind of this conservative, a sacrifice per se made to address climate change. In fact, there is an enormous opportunity. Our market is capable of addressing climate change and growing the economy at the same time. And we do need to focus that this idea that there has to be some sort of sacrifice, in other words, that something has to be given up, I think is something that does need to be managed very carefully going forward. So when we talk about the economy, we think about it from a local district perspective. We try to understand what that local impact is likely to be, and then plot a course out of that impact and focus on what is going to be, if you like, the prosperity of the future. And in my own state of Colorado, there's some very, very good examples of this, because we have a bunch of wind turbines as an example. And those wind turbines are now producing arguably more tax revenue than the wells that they were sitting on. And so there is no question that the transition needs to happen, but the transition can be managed without destroying the economy, which is a problem which needs to be recognized fully when we engage with conservatives about climate change. We can't destroy the economy in this process. That's a level of assumption and sacrifice which would be very, very difficult, I think, for most conservative Republican members to vote on, even though we believe that it's obviously an important issue to address. I've got one other point to make, and then we might go on to questions. I'm going to throw something in the chat in a moment, which is probably worth reading. There's been some work done over the last 4 or 5 months by an organization, which is called the Helena Project. And it's organized by a group called Americans in One Room. It is what is called deliberative polling. And deliberative polling is the idea that you engage people on issues, in this case, 70 odd questions, all built around climate change, but you actually take the time to work with everybody on those issues, on those specific questions in depth. In this case, they worked on it for about 10 hours, each individual. There's 1,000 people involved in this, to see whether or not their opinions are the same at the beginning and versus what's actually happened at the end. The deliberative polling that was done in the last few months has been very successful. It's right across the political spectrum, but the thing that's most interesting about it is how much people on the right-hand side find common ground with people on the left-hand side of the same argument once everybody understands the issue, and also the significant statistical adjustment in people's views after spending time, if you like, debating and understanding the issue correctly. So I'll post this later on when I get a moment to stop talking and have a look at that. But it's an extremely useful thing to do if you want to understand what conservatives are thinking when they started that and what they think 10 hours later. I think it's a very well worth study. It's well worth your review and your time to look at the study. Now, a couple of other things. Thank you. A couple of other things very briefly, and I'm going to talk a little bit about a sort of party level activity. Can you hold on 2 seconds? I've got too many people in the room. So one thing is worth bearing in mind is that under Kevin McCarthy, there's been a material adjustment in the preparation around how the Republican Party is going to think about climate change. This is driven by the fact that something like 70% of young conservatives, those that are under 30, consider climate change to be in the top three of their issues. So there's going to need to be a coherent strategy from the Republican Party going forward. This is a talking point, if you like. I'm providing this information, presenting it so that you can understand about how to talk to conservatives, because there is a large debate going on in conservative circles about what is the actual solution the conservatives will have to climate change. The two members of Congress that you're going to want to watch over the next couple of years, certainly into the next cycle, are Garrett Graves, which you may well be familiar with at the moment, but he's heading up the task force for climate change. That is going to be the Republican policy shop. That is where the ideas are going to be presented and formulated into a coherent strategy. You're going to see a lot of activity from that. And running alongside it, and equally as important, is going to be a huge educational effort, which is largely focused on Republican members of Congress. That is run by John Curtis, and he will be running, as I say, that education work over the next couple of years. Those two members of Congress are front and center of this debate. They've got the full support of their leadership. And I would expect, regardless of the outcome and what we achieve or don't achieve in reconciliation, as we move into the next Congress and out of this one next year, you're going to see a lot more activity, I think, from both of those. So you should be watching what they're saying and watching the policies develop from them. That will provide a great deal of content for how to engage with conservatives, because in my experience, this is a material change in the leadership that the Republicans are going to show around climate change. And it will be resetting the narrative. And there's a lot of work to do, and I recognize that. But anyway, that's worth watching. Okay, I'll stop there, and we can try and take some questions, maybe.
Appreciate it, Ian. I guess just to kick this off, my own personal question to you is if you have any personal stories of like where you've successfully had conversations with other conservatives that have brought them, you know, more in favor of the discussion. Just to give an example, and you and I have talked about this, but for the sake of everyone else, I have that the farmer friend of mine, veteran farmer, raises the Longhorn beef. Trying to talk to him about climate change was impossible. But the minute I stopped talking and just listened to what he cared about, he was more interested in his ability to reach out to his local market. He couldn't compete with beef prices from Walmart, you know, big box stores, things like that. So he had a very small demographic that he could sell his organic grass-fed beef to. So by listening to him and realizing that's what his top concern was, I was able to reapply something like the border adjustment and how it would make him more marketable as you no longer had cheap beef coming up out of South America. So while he may not have completely come to terms with climate change, he came to terms with a policy that would benefit him and climate change.
I'll answer very quickly because you did ask for example. I spend quite a lot of time in rural Colorado. Broadly the same experience. If you spend any time talking to someone who works on the land, they're usually conservative by nature. And ultimately, they are aware of the changes that are happening on the land. And the question is, what is happening in your district? And why do you think it's happening? I think it's important to ask questions as opposed to tell people what the solutions are or tell them why it's happening. It's best to ask. Now, somebody had their hand up earlier on and they disappeared.
We'll get down to the question here. Listed as the elephant in the room, how can we respond to Trumpism, which has its central element or has as its central element denial of facts and science?
The question here is respond. The answer is there is no response to a particular political point of view on any issue, whether it's climate change or any issue, when that issue is being used for partisan benefit. And so ultimately, I would push your climate discussions to be highly localized in district, in your town, in your county, and stay away from national partisan politics. And that would be true, frankly, whether you were dealing with guns as well as climate change. So I'm not entirely sure there's a response to it, and I certainly wouldn't pick a fight with it. Ultimately, this is a conversation about what's going on in your backyard. Work from that perspective with conservatives outwards to see if you can find common ground.
Very good. Joyce, would you like to unmute yourself and ask your question?
It's partially answered with that last one, but I'm going to ask again, because I have lobbied at several conservative Republican congressmen, one senator, and their statement is, why should we do anything when China is the world's biggest polluter?
Oh, I love this question. I'm so glad you asked this. Yes, there's a very good answer to this. Right. First of all, there's a chap out there called Gabe Collins, who works for Rice University. And if you're in the slightest interested about what we should do about China, Gabe is your man. He's written some stunning work around how we should deal with China. And it starts with a border carbon adjustment. He is a China hawk. And so the answer is very specifically that it should be that we should put a price on carbon because America actually has a lower carbon footprint for the big heavy industries than most of the rest of the world. But we are still the ones that are buying everything and arguably still one of the largest economies. So if we put a border carbon adjustment in place, then we are essentially forcing the hand of other large polluters if they still want to continue to do business with the US. So the answer is put a price on carbon, put a border carbon adjustment in place, read Gabe Collins at Rice University. Yes, that's the answer.
Yeah, and that's exactly the answer that I'd come up with, but I was hesitant because we were told by Danny Richter, don't talk about the border carbon adjustment with Republicans at this lobby session.
Well, then Danny wins on that one because he's the guy running the show. So you've asked me my opinion. Danny trumps that. So in this particular case, if we're not allowed to talk about the border carbon adjustment, it's going to make it difficult to engage in a conversation about China. But ultimately, we do have a carbon advantage. In America, which we've paid a huge price for over the last 20 years, largely led by regulation, frankly, that has made us with a smaller footprint. I don't think there's any way around that. It is now our advantage, and it is one that should be used. I don't have a good answer for you if you can't talk about the border carbon adjustment, I'm afraid.
Well, at least we're in agreement.
Yes.
All right, we're going to jump to the next one. Claude, if you want to go ahead and unmute yourself.
First, I just want to thank Joyce for speaking, and I'd love to find out how she was able to get into a meeting with her senators. I'm here in Florida, and that has proved unsuccessful so far. Ian, I'm in a group with a lot of conservative people, and most of them are interested on the national or even international scale. But how do you have a market-based solution for a problem of the magnitude of climate change, which is well beyond what Eisenhower did with the interstate highway system and looks much more like World War II? Do I lie to the conservatives and say, oh, we'll do this locally, we'll just have some carrots and sticks from the government, and we can keep it down to 1% of GDP or even less? How do you deal with the real economics? Do you avoid talking about the real price tags of what has to be done?
No, I don't think we avoid talking about the price tags of what has to be done at all. One of the hallmarks, if you like, of conservative thought, at least traditionally, is that we look things squarely in the face and understand exactly what is likely to happen. The reality is this, though, that there is trillions of dollars in the private sector way more money than government has access to. And one of the challenges that our government faces at the moment is that we run the debt up under multiple administrations to the point where we've actually got very little wiggle room to spend money. The private sector, though, is awash with money, partly because we've been printing money now for the best part of 20 years, on and off. A market mechanism is a signal sentiment as much as it's a reality. If there's a price on carbon, every brilliant American entrepreneur and engineer who has got an idea about a startup, which we start thousands of every day in this country, will look at that price on carbon, particularly if it escalates over time, and think, wait a minute, I can design something that will sell in the marketplace. That mechanism is far more powerful than any government level regulation to fix this problem. And we know that because look at the size of our economy and how it's grown over the last 100 years. So the trick is to send the signal and to put the price on carbon and let the market do the rest. The engineers and entrepreneurs and the young people of this country will solve the problem if we fix the issue of pricing externalities.
All right, let's go with Bill. And then if we have one more time, we'll get Arthur.
I live in San Antonio. And I've talked with a lot of conservatives. I'm surrounded by them, usually economists, and they see the local air here as being cleaner since the 70s. I'm going to put in the EPA also agrees with that as far as local air pollution, not global climate change pollution. So I'm wondering, how do you approach that? I mean, I've said that this... what we're talking about, climate change, is global, not local. It's not 74% cleaner than it was in 1990, like the EPA says, and that it's invisible versus visible. But I'm not supported by anybody, or nobody else does that. And
Bill, try a different metric. You are right, and actually that's true across much of America, in fact, that the air is in some ways cleaner than it was in the 1970s, but that's because we started putting catalytic converters on cars and they're leaner burn. Try measuring temperature as a good starting point. So we have a problem, and Texas has a problem. It's getting harder. The other thing is we might want to measure water. There's less water. So just change the metric. I mean, go looking for the other metrics. There is insufficient water, and there's certainly a temperature problem, and they are caused globally. So it's a question of finding and choosing your metric, but I wouldn't try and fight this. You're absolutely right. We had a problem in the 1960s, and we did something about it. And guess who fixed it? It was the market that fixed it with a properly regulated economy. So
right.
So put catalytic converters on it. It worked. Ford built them. GM built them. We solved the problem. Now we need to solve another problem. Let's stop talking about last year's problem and move to the current one, which is no water and hotter temperatures.
Actually, I also found out that the catalytic converter, which was put there to about particulate matter, creates CO2.
It's true. Yeah.
Okay, we're going to jump on to Arthur, and you'll be our last question, sir. I apologize if we didn't get to you.
All right. So what I like that I think market-based solutions is a way to go. But I think that's going to involve consumer demand, right? So I'm going to make a product that's green, but I need people to buy it. So do you have any thoughts on ways we can stimulate green demand to help drive the free market solutions with my green new company? Like, should we be like, how do we make the labradoodle cool? Now
right.
We have everyone's want these, you know, purebred dogs. How do I make that on the green? You got any thoughts?
Well,
on that?
I'm gonna twist your or reject your premise a little bit, and I hope you don't mind. The one of the great traps is to fall into this process of trying to make something that's green acceptable or cool or desirable. Actually, we just want a better product, period. And the issue is the test of whether it's green or not depends on the price on carbon. If there's a price on carbon, the greener option literally is cheaper. As it turns out, electric cars are actually in some ways better. They don't wear out. They require hardly any maintenance. They don't wear their brake pads out. We don't have oil flowing everywhere. And they're a hell of a lot easier to recycle. So the product itself arguably should be better. There is no point trying to convince anyone to buy something because it's green. Just make a better product. And the way that that gets done, particularly if it's cheaper, is to put a price on carbon. The moment we have a price on carbon, suddenly my Tundra truck is actually too damn expensive to drive and I will go and buy a Tesla or some other equivalent. That's the only mechanism we need. It's so staggeringly simple, but it's the only one that really is going to work. Forget trying to make green cool. We tried that for 20 years. It's not working. Just make a better product and put a price on carbon.
All right. With that said, we'll go ahead and wrap up here. Ian, I really appreciate you taking the time to come and talk to us. The rest of you, I apologize for not getting to your questions. Like Katie dropped in the chat, if you do, you want to keep the conversation going, I encourage you to join the Conservative Caucus Action Team and push your questions up on our community page, and one of us will get to you about it. So, all right. Thank you, everyone.
Just before we go, I've posted that link. If anyone wants to steal it right now out of the chat, I just did it. I think I posted it to everyone. Ugh. There we go. So if you grab that link, that's the deliberative polling work. Worth a look for those of you that are interested.
Sounds good. All right. Bye. Thank you, everyone. Enjoy your evening.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Citizens Climate Lobby's training program. You can tune into more episodes anywhere podcasts are available. Inspired by what you heard today? Join Citizens Climate Lobby to advocate for bipartisan climate solutions. Go to community.citizensclimate.org to find more trainings, resources, your local chapter, national action teams, discussion forums, and more. Be sure to like our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Citizens Climate. We also invite all of our listeners to subscribe to our YouTube channel for more inspiration. And together, we are creating the political will for a livable world.